Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Wednesday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. talking with authors, editors, agents, and poets about writing. Tonight my guest is Mary Morris, author of Aliens and Angels, A Journey West. Mary was born in 1947 in Chicago and grew up in the Midwest. In her early 20s, she began traveling extensively and living abroad in places such as France, Mexico, and Italy. At this time, Morris began writing short stories, which were published in literary magazines. Her stories have also been published in magazines such as Vogue, The Paris Review, and McCall's. In 1979, Mary Morris's first collection of short stories, Vanishing Animals and Other Stories, was published by David Godin. It was awarded the Rome Prize in Literature. Since then, Mary Morris has published 10 works, including 3 collections of stories and 4 novels. Among them are The Lifeguard, House Arrest, The Night Sky, and 3 travel memoirs, Nothing to Declare, Memoirs of a Woman Traveling Alone, Wall to Wall, From Beijing to Berlin Alone, and most recently in what we're going to be talking about tonight, Angels and Aliens, A Journey West. Mary Morris also co-edits Maiden Voyages, an anthology of women's travel literature, with her husband, Larry O'Connor. She's been awarded grants from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Creative Artists Public Service Awards. Further, her work has been published in England, Japan, Spain, Italy, Germany, Holland, and Sweden. A professor at Sarah Lawrence College, Mary Morris currently lives in Brooklyn, New York, with her husband and her daughter. Welcome, Mary.
Yes.
Wonderful to have you.
Thanks, Barbara. Same. Wonderful to be here.
I quite enjoyed Angels and Aliens. It was brought to my attention, interestingly, by a man who, I no longer know his name, but he accompanied mystery author Martha Lawrence to a signing in Costa Mesa, and she's been on the show a few times, and I went to see her.
Uh-huh.
And he came up to me. I guess his wife is a publicist in Beverly Hills and apparently knows you, and I cannot remember their name. But anyway, and he held
you. Was he Jeff? Was he, you don't remember his name.
I don't remember his name.
Okay.
He's kind of short. I don't know.
Yes, I know who he is.
Yeah.
He was on L.A. Law.
Okay.
A long time ago.
That could be.
He was Errol Farrell. Anyway.
You're kidding me.
I was in L.A. Law. obsessed at a certain point in my life, so.
Well, that's interesting, because I knew he looked familiar.
Yeah, I know. He took me around when I was in L.A.
Well, that was him, and he brought your book to me, because he knew I had this show.
Right.
And he held it in front of my face, and he said, now, you have to have this person on.
That's great.
And I love the cover, and I immediately, I guess, contacted your publisher and got the book, so on and so forth. But in any case, what led you to write Angels and Aliens?
Well, I suppose the main thing was the year I lived in California. I guess there's two separate questions. I mean, one was what led me to sort of explore that world in the way I explored it, and then the other is what led me to write it. And I had collected files of my year in California. I mean, I really got interested in all the sort of, quirky and odd little bits of California memorabilia that I collected along my way, and I kept them in extensive files for a very long time, I mean, over 10 years. But I had always wanted to write this book. It just had always seemed a journey, a part of my life, a sort of piece of Americana that I wanted to write.
Did you take notes and did you keep a journal and all that while you were out here?
I keep extensive journals. And while I was out there, a lot of the scenes that are in the book actually were in my journals, almost as they happened. There are two sort of parts of my life. One is as a fiction writer, and the other is the travel and memoir stuff. And basically, I spend a lot of time just roughing things out in my journals. So sometimes I open them up, and work is already there, mm-hmm. very much like an artist would use a sketchbook.
Mm-hmm. So you lived here in '88, and taught here at UCI,
right?
And When did you know all that time was going to end up in a book, or did you know as you were living it? Is that something that you know as you're doing something, or traveling or whatever it might be, do you know that it's going to at some point be a book, or maybe one experience will and the other won't?
Well, can I give you an anecdote as
sure.
by way of experience? I mean, at the end of this book tour, I was flying back from the Midwest, and I was just exhausted. I'd been on about 15 planes, and I was delayed, and I was late at night, and I sat down next to a man, and he started talking to me. It was sort of like the last thing I wanted was someone to talk to me. And he started talking about all of his business dealings that he had to do and so on and so forth. So finally I said to him, well, what do you do? And he said, I'm a dessert specialist. And I said, what do you mean? What do you do? And he said, well, I taste desserts all over the world. So I had to talk to him. I mean, I knew he was going to be a character
uh-huh.
at some point. I mean, I knew I was going to use a dessert specialist, so I really had to know, like, what he really felt about pecan pie, and if he really liked tiramisu, was it overrated? And we just talked, you know, for 2 or 3 hours about dessert. And sometimes, you know, something like that will happen, and I'm sort of, maybe my defenses are down or whatever, and a moment will happen, and I think that feels like something that will become grist for the mill down the road. You know, in all fairness to California, there are parts of it. I mean, the same could be done with New York, of course, but there are parts of it that are different and strange. And somehow I managed to tap into them. And as I was doing it, I kept thinking, well, this will become a part of something. And initially it was going to be a part of fiction. There's a novel that was published called A Mother's Love that has been reissued with its original title, which is The Night Sky. And a lot of that sort of California wandering and is in that book.
Mm-hmm.
But the New Age stuff and the extraterrestrials and the angels didn't really work into the fiction, and at some point I just knew it was nonfiction. And, you know, I don't throw things out. I mean, shoes, you know, I'm a pack rat, and I just hold on to stuff.
So are there things that happened while you were out here that will find their way, say, into a novel that didn't belong in this book?
Actually, I think that the novel, that it found its way into, it's a pretty tight, compact novel. You know, if somebody ever wanted to write a sort of a paper on this, I mean, it would be interesting to take The Night Sky and then take Angels and Aliens and sort of see, for example, there's a lot of crossover in the Las Vegas material. Some
mm-hmm.
of the desert material crosses over. But I think I've basically, you know, drawn from all the pieces of that year. I'm in a very different place in my work now anyway than I was when I lived in California, or even when I wrote Angels and Aliens. I've kind of gone into a much more imaginative work, which I'm somewhat happier with at
mm-hmm.
the moment. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think I've tapped everything except the Madonna Inn. The Madonna Inn is just one place that I would love to do more with down the road.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really, it's sort of like walking into someone's imagination when you go there.
One place I haven't been, I've been by it driving, you know, from San Francisco mm-hmm. to here and back, and I've never stopped. And
well, you should. It's
yeah.
really, Mrs. Madonna, these are all her sort of ideas she comes up with for different rooms,
mm-hmm.
and then the thematic of it. And I'm interested in Americana. I mean, you know, I love Europe, and I love things European, and one of the things that fascinated me with California, particularly, for example, at a place like Forest Lawn, is this desire to replicate great art
mm-hmm.
rather than, in a sense, making one's own. Like, why would you need to, you know, recreate the Last Supper or the David or, you know, the need. You know, I think there is in California this desire for facsimile, I mean, to replicate. Because in a sense, your history, unlike the history of other places, you've made your history.
Mm-hmm.
Most other places have organically lived a history, but yours has been sort of a construct.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's one of the things I love about David Hockney is I think he's truly an original California artist, and many other California artists too, but Hockney comes to mind as sort of being kind of quintessential in that way. But so much of what is there, I mean, it's one of the things that fascinates me about Disneyland is, you know, why do you need to recreate the Mississippi, you know, or,
right.
or you know, all of that American desire to, at replication and facsimile.
Mm-hmm.
It fascinates me, and the Madonna into me is a sort of a piece of all that need to replicate things,
mm-hmm.
in a way. The sort of theme, the thematic theme park mentality, and what that's really about.
Will you read from your book?
Oh, sure.
Angels and Aliens?
I would love to. Shall I preface this a little
bit?
Sure. Well, it's 1987, and I'm a single parent. I've taken a job at UC Irvine. It's not the greatest time in my life. I'm sort of hoping that things will work out with my daughter's father, biological father, and so I'll just read a little excerpt.
Okay.
I'm living in Laguna at the time. There's a man named Stan who takes care of the bungalow I have rented from a nice family who went to Ireland for the year. He has a Beam Me Up Jesus bumper sticker on the back of his Jeep. Stan and his wife Kathy live in the studio attached to my bungalow. On the patio there is a small sandbox whose contents his cat uses as a litter. And for the year I'm living there, he promises to put a lid on it, but never does. The patio is filled with lumber because Stan is building a back porch. He is almost deaf, which I don't realize until Kathy tells me. Indeed, when I told Stan the faucet dripped, he said, "I don't hear a thing." Our neighbors are a couple with two boys, and they seem willing to share child care. I made this arrangement sight unseen before leaving New York. They have a Mormon babysitter, Janelle, who is about 20 years old and humorless. She wears a big engagement ring on her finger, and purple eyeliner is spread thickly across her lids. The TV is always on when I go to drop Kate off. I pay only $2.50 an hour, which is all I can afford, so I shouldn't complain, but I do. I ask her to keep the TV off and play with the kids. "Oh, I take them to the beach," she says. In fact, my neighbor Monica and I have purchased a double stroller. The older boy Max can walk. I do come back to find Kate bronzed, freckles on her nose, but glazed in front of Sesame Street. I try to talk to Monica about this, but it's difficult. She says they just chill out that way. She and her husband Mike met on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride at Disneyland when they were 14. They've been together ever since. When Monica describes for me how they were thrown together as the ride splashed along, soaking them, pirates shouting, she blushes. He is a waiter at an upscale restaurant in town, but he's writing short stories and screenplays. He says he wants to show them to me, but in all the time I'm there, I never see a word he writes. At school, they call me their writer-in-residence. My students are tall blondes with domestic tales to tell, Vietnamese with boat stories, Hispanics with the woes of immigration and a hunger for the American dream. Some of my students drive me wild, one in particular. He has a handlebar mustache, wears suspenders and a fantasy island pin. He's writing his own version of Narnia and spends long sessions in my office. He brings me maps executed in minute detail, explaining how his kingdom works. Underground tunnels where antimatter creatures live like moles. He has a whole theory about life on the other side of mirrors. He believes in elves. Much of my day I spend driving from one place to another. As I drive, I begin to notice the license plates. One of my neighbors has a plate that reads Top Gums. There's an old lady who drives a Mercedes, and hers says Fun Fox. The drivers are pretty aggressive, and I have to do some fancy maneuvering, but I like being in the car cruising. It is, however, the time of drive-by shootings. Not far from where I live, a young man is shot in the neck, paralyzed from the waist down. I drive defensively, eyes straight ahead. I keep a pad with me and write down license plates. Enjoyment, I create, live in for now. Another reads, missing link, which I can't figure out at the time. Still, I write it on my pad. I contemplate what my license plate might read, but nothing seems right. Even though it is out of my way, I like the stretch of road through Laguna Canyon, the one that takes me past Ralph's VW shop. It's a narrow, beautiful road that seems to twist of its own accord. In 1998, in the season of El Nino, this road will serve as a conduit for mudslides, carrying furniture to the sea, smothering a young man in its wake. But for now, in September, it is redolent with the smell of oranges and in the spring, strawberries. Already the migrant workers are beginning to prepare its fields. Hawks soar over the hills. In the evening, this canyon road leaves me dizzy. Later I will learn there is a legend about it. The Laguna Indians were angry about this path being carved through their canyon. In So a spirit makes the roadway shift at night, hurling automobiles into the lights of oncoming cars. It is true that this road is infamous for the head-on collisions that happen at night. Years later, this canyon will burn in the brush fires of the late 90s. I will be flying into Los Angeles, and a firefighter sitting next to me will point out Laguna Canyon where he's headed. The fire just swept through that canyon, he told me, like someone was chasing it.
Hmm.
So I'll stop there for now.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Does that sort of sound like Orange County to you, or Laguna?
It does.
The canyon road still there?
It does. It's still here. There's a freeway now. There may have been protests during the time you lived here.
Save a freeway through the canyon?
Yeah, there's a freeway through the canyon heading from Newport Beach, Irvine to San Juan Capistrano, basically, and you know, for all the new development up on the hill.
Yeah.
And
does it cut across?
It cuts across, and
I'm sorry about that.
Well,
this is what happens. On my tour, I flew down the coast from L.A. to San Diego, and I don't think I'd ever really flown, and I was just stunned at the amount of development. I mean, it's not a square inch seems, you know. You're pretty packed in there.
We're packed in here, and it keeps happening. And now, right up here on Newport Coast, sort of between Laguna and Newport and UCI, up on the hill behind UCI, there's million-dollar houses going up, and people are just moving into them as fast as they can.
Wow.
It's very
amazing.
Very bizarre. Anyway.
Yes.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and my guest is Mary Morris, who just read from her most recent book, Angels and Aliens. As well as it being a memoir, it's also evident that, you know, that being from back east, you did so much research about Southern California. For instance, what you just read about Laguna Canyon, I didn't know that, and I've lived here maybe 11 years.
I did a lot of research.
What sort of things did you find? I mean, did you find out a lot of things that were surprising to you, or was it what you expected? And curious about the process of researching and combining that with memoir.
Well, when I lived in California, I was obsessed with California. I read everything I could. I read, there's a book called Unknown California, which has a lot of essays. One person who was an invaluable source was Carrie McWilliams, who wrote a lot about cults and movements and belief systems in the 40s. And he could pack more into an essay than just about anyone I know. And, you know, his work was fantastic. There were just a lot of things that I learned. Another book that was really helpful was City of Nets. Usually what I do, if I want to understand a place, there are no footnotes or bibliography in my books. It's kind of a conscious decision. I don't want these to be viewed as, these aren't research, you know, nonfiction books in that way.
Well, it very much reads as fiction.
What?
It very much reads as fiction.
Right. Well, I thank you. I mean, I work hard to craft it as that way. So there's a story and a narrative. But what I tend to do is I read a lot when I first get interested in the subject or whatever it is, and I take extensive notes, and then I really don't look at them again, and I just write it down. And then what happens is a copy editor or fact checker comes along and says, you know, are you sure that, you know, that the mice don't come from California? And I go back to my sources, and I find that, you know, all your animals and plants except for your desert stuff comes from somewhere else. So you know, so I do the research, but then which is also the way I do fiction. I mean, I'll do research for fiction, and then I put it away, and I don't never think about it again. And then someone will say to me, oh, did that really happen? And sometimes I don't even know where my imagination stopped and, you know, or where fact stopped and my imagination took over.
Mm-hmm.
But so far I haven't gotten any letters from anyone saying that, you know, I got this wrong or that wrong, except for my father and my cousin who told me I don't know a thing about betting on horses and mistakes in the horse racing chapter, which I have to correct. But I like the research to become you know, rather than sitting with a bunch of other people's words next to me, I let it sort of, I try to absorb the information.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, originally when I sat down to write this book, I thought, in fact, that it was going to be much more research and sociologically driven and much less personal, but it just turned into a personal book. I mean, I didn't seem to have much say in the matter, which is what happens when you're writing a book anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just sort of, it does what it wants, you know, like a child, really.
Mm-hmm.
I heard a great description, Andrea Barrett, who won the National Book Award, mm-hmm. said that when you start to write a book, it's like when you're making Jello, because when it's really mushy and you can do anything you want with it,
mm-hmm.
but once it starts to harden, then you can put the marshmallows in, but after it hardens, you can't do anything with it anymore. It is what it is, and it just sort of becomes the thing. I think, you know, that's what happened. I mean, I mean, all of my three travel memoirs all have a very personal side to them. But in fact, Wall to Wall, I remember when it was published in England, the British press said that one reviewer said, you'll never read another travel book like this again, because it's an inordinately personal travel book. There's some mm-hmm. very personal things in it. Yet it still is a journey. So, but the research is definitely an important layer.
Speaking of personal travel books, was that something you consciously set out to do, or did the three books that are considered travel memoirs, did they evolve that way? Or perhaps the first one?
Well, you know, what happened was, it's kind of an interesting little story. I was kind of in the middle of a novel, and it wasn't going quite the way I wanted to, and I was frustrated. My editor took me to lunch, and we were kind of chatting about, you know, what I wanted to do next, and the New York Times had just published this special summer issue of travel books, and they were 27 books by men. And I said to her, you know, isn't this funny? You know, women don't write about travel, and this was about 85. And she said, well, you know, you travel all the time and you don't write about it, and, you know, why don't you write about it? So I thought, well, that was sort of interesting, and I went back to some of my journals where I had already done quite a bit of traveling, and I thought, well, maybe I'll write a travel book. So I went out and I bought a bunch of books. I bought Paul Theroux, and, you know, I bought whoever I could get my hands on, and I read them, and the only one I really loved, and I may be getting my years wrong now, but there were a couple that I really loved, but one was The Snow Leopard by Peter Matheson.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, it's not a travel book, but he starts off by telling you who he is and about his wife dying and about his Buddhist belief and his children and why he decided to go on the journey. And also I loved Henry Miller's The Colossus of Maruzi. And I thought to myself that, you know, no one has ever really kind of given validity to the way women move through the world.
Mm-hmm.
Men move through the world differently than women for a lot of reasons. And I know that my experiences are very different than a man's experience, and that if I was going to really tell how I took a journey, I would have to put myself in it, because that's the way I move through the world. That's one piece of how I move through the world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a more subjective eye than Paul Theroux. While I admire what he does, it seems to be obliquely filtered through him, but not, I don't know him enough to understand, you know, why he's so cantankerous, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why he's in certain moods. So I just had this sort of, like someone in Japan once said to me, I thought this was interesting, he said, you don't really write travel books, you write stories that happen during journeys.
Interesting.
And I thought that seemed like a pretty good definition for that piece of my writing.
Yes. Well, we're going to take a break, give you a chance to take a sip of something, and
okay.
We'll be back in just a few minutes, so stay tuned, and we'll talk more with Mary Morris.
Come back, baby, please. please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
We are back. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and tonight I'm talking with Mary Morris, author of Aliens and Angels, A Journey West. Mary, you're so open in this book. It's, you know, you were saying earlier about Paul Thoreau that you didn't feel that you necessarily knew him any better through reading the book.
Right.
And this book of yours, how is it to sort of put your life on the page in such a vulnerable manner? I mean, you're just
well,
right there.
This is a hard book to write in that regard, and it wasn't easy. You know, I mean, that's probably the best way I can say it. What basically happened was I didn't feel like I could write about me going into the New Age without explaining. I mean, I was trying to cope with my own life. I wanted to see how other people coped. Well, why was I having trouble coping with my life, and how did I get there in the first place? I mean, I felt all these pieces needed to be explained. To be honest, the only person I was really uncomfortable about was my father. I was afraid of how he would read this book. Mm-hmm. And I went down to Florida in January, and my parents threatened to go buy every book I've written, they've read in galleys or they've read in manuscript. But this was the only one I didn't show them. And finally they threatened to go and buy it. And I said, well, no, I'll bring it to you. And when I got there, my mom started it, and but then my dad picked it up. He's 96 years old. And
wow.
He sat down and he read it in about, I don't know, two sittings. And he loved it. He really liked it. He thought it was really good. And so I don't know. You know, that once that was over, that was the worst of it for me.
Mm-hmm.
That I had, his blessing with the book, excuse me, getting over a New York cold.
Mm. Well, your dad, I thought, was portrayed pretty nicely, especially there was a pretty emotional moment with, overhearing a conversation as a teenager where, you know, he said, you know, we'd always take Mary in, no matter what she'd do.
Right. We had this bluff behind our house, and I always knew that if I ever, like, got pregnant or got into trouble, I would throw myself off of it. It was how I was going to kill myself. And I should add that, you know, getting pregnant or anything like that was a very dim and distant possibility at that point in my life. But I had this whole fantasy worked out, and a friend of mine in our junior year in high school actually did get pregnant with her boyfriend, and her father threw her out of the house, and I did overhear my father telling my friend's father that they would always take me in, and that, you know, was very important for me to understand that. I'd always thought that my parents, particularly my father, were very concerned.
When you sold this book, you were obviously already well published, but was there interest in the Orange County setting, or could, do you think it could have been anywhere and it would have been the same in terms of the response?
There was interest in the New Age stuff after Heaven's Gate committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
That was basically it. It wasn't, and there were people interested in me doing another travel memoir, but it wasn't, the Orange County thing was not, in fact, if anything, you know, I think if I had done, you know, Madagascar, I would have had a much easier chance of, you know, I mean, the publisher, Picador USA, who publishes me now, I mean, they really wanted to publish me as an author, and they were willing to make a pretty good commitment to me, you know, for this book and other books,
mm-hmm.
several other books. I don't think the California thing was not a piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, New York does love to poke fun at California, as I know California loves to poke fun.
Of course.
Actually, at one point, thought of doing a small essay on California jokes in New York films and New York jokes in California films, because there's a lot of them. Some of them are hilarious.
As you mentioned earlier, this book very much has a beginning and end. It's like a novel that way.
Right.
Did you outline it or plot it as you might a novel, or was it pretty fluid? Did you just start writing or pick a place and it just...
Well, it's sort of both for me. I mean, I don't write in a linear way. It's sort of one thing kind of builds on the next. Excuse me, I'm going to have to cough. Apologize.
That's okay.
One thing sort of builds on the next, and I wish there was a simple answer. There is often a point where I never outline before I write. I mean, I write. I don't believe in outlining. E.L. Doctorow said that writing is like driving on a country road at night in the dark. You can't see further than your headlights, and I think that there's a lot of truth in that, that really, when you're really writing, the only way you know what you're going to write is by writing it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know it by outlining it or thinking about it or, you know, I suppose some writers do, but I don't believe in any of that. So, I mean, I don't know, there's just a way of telling a story, and I guess I just sort of found that way. Not a very good answer, I'm afraid.
That's all right. How many years after you lived here did you actually start writing this book?
And about 10 years.
Well, how did you plug into the emotion of that time? Because it is as if...
Right. It was hard. It was hard to write that book for that reason. I mean, you know, I'm married now. I'm sort of way beyond this book. And I, you know, I had to kind of dig back into some material that wasn't exactly fun to dig into. But see, it's all in my journals. So I just sort of open it and read them. And I'm kind of thrown back to, you know, 1986, 1987, whenever.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of what... it's not easy, you know, writing. I mean, that because of those reasons. You know, you have to sort of... you know, reach into places that may not be so comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Do you prefer writing fiction over writing nonfiction, or the other way around?
Yeah, I love to write fiction. I just love it, and I like writing the nonfiction too. But it just doesn't do the same thing for me as the fiction. And I've had this sort of peculiar career in that I've a very good reputation as a nonfiction writer, but it's not where my heart is, really. You know?
What do you think is that thing that is different about writing fiction for you?
Well, the imagination, the texturing, the subtlety of the storytelling. You know, you're making it up. In nonfiction, even though there's an arc of a story here and all that, I mean, basically everything that happened, happened. You know, so I'm just drawing from what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Speaking of what happened.
Yeah.
There's some great stuff in here. The Vegas scenes with Irish.
Oh, yeah, I love Irish.
That was, I don't know, I never go to Vegas, but I always find any writing about it just fascinating.
Mm-hmm. He was great, though. I mean, he was a particularly amazing character, and I really had a blast with him. my mother dug this guy up, and I don't know if you want. Am I going to read again later?
Would you like to?
I don't know. I could read the. I could read the, a little bit of Irish.
Okay, let's do that right now.
You want to do that now?
Yeah. And you're.
Sorry, I keep clearing my throat here.
That's all right. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and Mary Morris is going to read from Angels and Aliens.
Yeah, I was going to read some of the funny parts about Orange County, but that's okay because you know those parts anyway. Let me just. I'm going to have to poke around here. So if you have another question you want to ask while I'm looking for Irish,
I'm curious what you thought might be the reactions to this book from people here in Orange County. I see that you didn't do any book tour touring down here.
I didn't. I was chicken. And, you know, it's funny. I thought I was going to be tarred and feathered, and I thought people were going to be really mean. But, well, I did do Esmeraldas in San Diego, but that's not,
that's not Orange County.
No. Nobody invited me, I think, though, also.
Next time,
you know, I think looking back, I should have done something. And if really I was chicken, I mean that's it. You know, I'm going to be really straight about that. I was afraid, and I just didn't do it. But I think it would have been fine. When I read in Esmeraldas, people just howled. I mean, they thought it was so funny, and that surprised me. I didn't think that I would get, you know, that kind of really good sense of humor reactions from people. I thought people would be mad.
Hmm.
They didn't seem to be mad. I mean, they seemed to take it in good stride and, you know, kind of good fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think, and, you know, a number of reviewers have said this, that I tried to be well, let's see. I mean, maybe when I was there, I was a little ironical in my own thinking about the people that I met and things that I saw and experienced, particularly the New Age stuff. But when I sat down to write the book, I really wanted to write something that reflected a certain amount of understanding and compassion. And, you know, so I really did work hard at not poking fun, but actually being more understanding. So I, you know. Well, how do you think it would have played down there?
Well, gee, you know, I live here and I love the book, so
right.
I think maybe, you know, I don't think the people you might offend would read it, probably. You know, people that are sort of the conservative set who
right.
are just, you know, who probably
right.
who knows if they read books. I don't know. I suppose they do, but I don't know. This
mm-hmm.
I think your readership for this book wouldn't be offended and would find it interesting and amusing and relate, because so many of us are from elsewhere. I'm from back
right.
east. And
where are you from?
Originally Pennsylvania, and I went to school in Vermont and, you know, lived in San Francisco for a long time before coming down here reluctantly. So, you know, I think a lot
right.
of us just relate.
Right. Well, and I think also the fact just what, you know, the way you described your migration, I think a lot of people have similar migrations, or some, you know, some, they came from somewhere else, and so, you know, it's very different. I remember when I was in, we lived in the Southwest for a while, and I remember I was fascinated with the fact that, I mean, I met one man who lived on the same land that his family had owned for 400 years.
Hmm.
And, you know, you just, obviously, you're not going to find that in California, so people are all coming from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want me to read this
yeah.
Irish
yeah.
passage? Okay, this is chapter 36. Isidore Irish Figler is an old Chicago boy who works with the big wheel at the Riviera in Vegas. He's a friend of some friends of my mother who has told me that if I make it to Vegas, Irish will show me around. Irish Figler, I ask her, but she says that's his name, and don't call him, she tells me, just show up. I make a weekend arrangement with Ramona to watch Kate, agreeing to pay her overtime. Surely I'll make up the money in Vegas. I leave at crack of dawn, heading due east from my house, past Barstow, past Summit, a desert road I've come to know fairly well. I stop for gas, eat a decent breakfast, and by lunchtime I'm checking into the Nugget, which is cheaper than the big hotels on the Strip. In the lobby, I found myself surrounded by slots and by old ladies who wear gloves that keep their hands from bleeding. That's true, actually. I head over to the Riviera, where it doesn't take too long to find a nice Jewish boy with flaming red hair and pale green eyes built like prime rib, with a silver dollar set inside a gold ring on one of the many chains dangling from his hairy neck. He sees me skulking up to the wheel he spins. When I tell him I'm the girl from Chicago Iris sent, Iris gives the wheel one last spin. Then he shouts to his pit boss, "I'm on break. I gotta take this dame around." His boss, a balding man in a black tuxedo, gives him a shrug. We head over to the bar where we order Diet Cokes. When he's sure he's out of earshot of the pit boss, he points a finger in my face. "Never, never bet on the wheel. You can bet on blackjack," Iris tells me. "You got your best chance there, especially if you're a systems player, but the rest of the stuff is a crapshoot, literally. You may as well be playing Russian roulette." We sit down at a table in a quiet corner of the casino. I've been in this town years now, don't ask me how many. I can tell you there's more people buried in the hills than in the cemeteries. Anyway, in Vegas, if you ain't got money, you got memories. After our cokes, Iris tells his pit boss he's gone for the day. The boss gives another shrug, as if this doesn't surprise him, and tells him to have a good time. I figure that since my mother set this meeting up, it's safe. But still, it's a little strange to be moving through the world of Vegas with a dealer I just met. He takes me over to Vegas World, where I stare up at the starry ceiling, the giant purple illuminated pods, lava lamps everywhere, a weightless astronaut sailing overhead, a giant Wheel of Fortune space station. "You got some money?" Iris asks me. I tell him I have a little. "I've brought $200 for gambling. The rest for a night in a hotel, a visit to a spa in the morning, and the drive home." "Okay, let's get you some chips." He gets me $200 worth of white, red, green, and black chips. "You need $500 for a blue one. You ain't got $500, do you?" I shake my head. "That's okay," he says. "Let's see if you can't win us dinner." On our way to blackjack, Iris pauses at the poker table. He scrutinizes the game there, then pulls me away. "See that guy?" He points to a nerdy-looking man in glasses, a suit, a loser if I ever saw one. "He's a Sitting Bull, a pro. He pretends he doesn't know how to play, then beats your pants off. Let's get out of here." He tugs me off to the blackjack tables and finds a game and a dealer he likes. "Okay," Iris says, "hit me." The dealer begins to deal. I'm just sitting there, but I watch Iris tell the dealer when to hit him and when to raise him. If there's a system here, it's lost on me, but Iris seems to know it. He wins a little for me and then loses a little. I whisper into his ear, "Let's do something else," pointing to roulette. He shakes his head. "Never the wheel. Never the slots." An hour later, he's made $100. "Okay, cash in your chips. Let's take a ride. I'll show you where the people live." But I want to keep playing. He earned me an easy $100. That should take care of dinner. Now maybe he could earn me a few hundred more to cover Ramona's weekend cost. Let's play more. He shakes his head, walking through the windowless, clockless casino. Nope. His car is silver and smells a little oily. The passenger seat is pushed far back, and I can't move it up, but I'm enjoying Irish's company. We drive along, and he points out the sights. That's where the Mirage is going up after they tear the Flamingo down. I tell Irish I want to stop and gamble some more. "You've played enough," he says. "We won a little. That's good. That's enough." The compulsive gambler, he's really playing to lose. If you don't quit when you're ahead, then you're a loser. Pretty simple. Throw caution to the wind, that's the sign of a loser. They want money to cover everything, like a blanket over your real self. Realizing I've got some version of the Vegas prophet with me, I just let Irish drive me down Paradise Road towards the west side of town. We pass the Guardian Angels Catholic Church near the Desert Inn, past the Wee O' Kirk of the Heather Marriage Chapel in the direction of what Irish calls the Naked City. That's a trailer park where showgirls used to live. It was called the Naked City because the girls sunbathed nude to get even tans. He points to a fence, and on the other side, I imagine those showgirls, their bodies bronzed and naked, men like Irish peering over the fence. In this town, Irish goes on apropos of nothing. You're living in hope and you're dying in spirit. You gotta gamble if, when, like a junkie. A gambler will do anything just so he can play one more day. If he can't play, he gets depressed. He'll steal. I know women, nice women who sell their bodies. As he drives, I can't help thinking that I've got $100 more than I came with. If we could just keep on at the blackjack, then maybe I'd be ahead. We pull into the trailer park, where an old woman with bleached hair and lipstick, riding up the creases of her lips, is standing on her AstroTurf porch. "Iris," she shouts, "come on in and have a beer." When we get out, I take a look at Selma. A ton of blue makeup is smeared around her eyes, and Selma has no hair, actually, mainly scabs and a very bad wig. She has plastic flowers in pots all around the trailer, and there are Christmas ornaments on the trees. She seems very happy to see us. In a matter of minutes, Selma tells me how she's from Minnesota and came here in the 1960s. She was a kino runner at Bailey's. Never left, she tells me. She's also never married, though she lives with her boyfriend, Al, who's a bellman at the Tropicana, and she tells me with a cackle, waiting for the Messiah. That night over dinner, Irish informs me that the first sign of insanity in Vegas is to lose and keep laughing, the I-don't-care attitude. You know, he goes on looking into his scotch. Success can be counted in a lot of ways, not just money. But in this town, the bottom line is money. Nothing else matters, not the good deeds you do or the cures for cancer you find or the beautiful poems you write. Just money matters. Can't buy love, let me tell you. I've caught my nieces and my nephews and friends so many times, but that doesn't buy me love. Irish looks sad now. Maybe he knows I'm just one more person he's never going to see again. But still, I like to sit around and tell stories and lie, he says. When the check comes, Irish picks up the tab, despite my protests. But you won me that $100, I said. That's okay, lady. Go home rich. He asked me to kiss his silver dollar ring. And get lucky, he says.
That's great.
Thanks. That actually, you know, it's funny. I have this strange ability when somebody's telling me stuff. If I really like it, I can memorize exactly what they're saying. So, and then I quickly write it down when I'm not with him anymore. So everything that he said, somehow I memorized it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Maybe I made a few notes. I don't remember, but I remember that basically all that stuff about all of his philosophy and all of his kind of, you know, I just memorized it, and then it's sort of like I keep running the lines over in my head even while I'm in a conversation with him.
How about the details like, you know, Selma's flower pots or her wig? Do you make notes
about that
kind of stuff?
Oh, you couldn't forget Selma. I mean, you know, like, you just take one look at her, and it's sort of like this wizened head with these blue circles around it and this scab. It was just, you know, I just sort of record, you know, I mean, sometimes I'm somewhere and I got to write something down, but sometimes I just say I memorize it, and it creates a sort of like a mother, you know, you can have one conversation yet be sort of talking to your kid or telling your kid what to do. I don't know, somehow I'm able to sort of memorize and, you know, what I need to know.
I'm curious, how did living in Laguna Beach for that year change you? What did you bring away or take away with you when you left?
One of the things, and I think this is what the book's about, is that I think I really sort of arrived there kind of a victim of my own life. And I left with a real sense that I could turn things around, change things. There were some friends I made whose kindness has overwhelmed me. One, a wonderful woman named Sylvia Easton, who lived in Irvine, and her husband, Dave Easton. And other friends, Mary Jane Roberts. I mean, other people who just, you know, their kindness was so important to me at a time in my life that I just felt very blessed. You know, when I was struggling to make sense out of what was going on around me. So the book is partially dedicated to this journalist, Leslie Ernst, who arrived unexpectedly on Mother's Day. I didn't even know this woman, and found me in tears and cleaned my house. So, you know, those kinds of things. You know, I love New York, but people don't arrive unexpectedly on Mother's Day and clean your house. But, you know, I feel they're, you know, without sounding too hokey, I mean, I do think there are angels who kind of come into our lives when we need them, and, you know, people who can, you know, be, yeah, I don't know, people can somehow appear in a way when we need them.
They sure can.
Yeah.
We have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you real quickly about your teaching and how that affects your writing. Does it distract you, or does it feed your writing?
Well, I've been fortunate in that I've been able to go to a half-time appointment now. And I find that my teaching feeds my writing if I don't do too much of it. But if I do so much that I'm very distracted and overwhelmed, it's not a good thing. But what I like is having just the right balance where I've got, you know, like one class a semester and, you know, 15 students, and I can sort of, you know, have them read stuff that I want to read, and that works really well for me. But if it's two classes and, you know, if it's too much, I can't get anything done, and all I do is think about teaching. And, you know, it's always a tricky thing because writers, you know, have to earn a living. Not that many of us can earn a steady living from our writing, and still have the integrity of our work. So, you know, you have to strike the balance between teaching and, you know, it's just a balance that one has to strike.
Mm-hmm. Any advice for the writers who may be listening? There's so many things I still want to talk to you about, and we're out of time, but,
yeah,
you know, things like the UFE Abductee Group and the, you know, Ashtar,
right,
and Crystal,
right,
Cathedral, but if the listeners get your book, they'll get to read about it.
They'll know about that. Well, I think the most important piece of my life is, I've said I'm a pack rat and I hold on to everything, but I think the most important thing for me is revision. Is, you know, taking the material that I've thrown together and honing it and polishing it so many times that I can't even stand to look at it anymore. But somehow that process of revision really is what enables the story to come to the surface. It's rendered, in a sense. And, you know, I can't tell you the number of writers and students and people that I've worked with, the ones who I felt were really going to do something with their writing were the ones that could go back into their work and look at it again and revise it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just such an important part of the process. I don't know that anyone ever sat down and wrote a masterpiece. I mean, just like that, you know. Maybe Shakespeare, okay. But, you know, most of us mere mortals, we have to revise and go back and rethink.
Yes.
Also, if you've seen Shakespeare in Love, he revised all the time.
Well, I sure thank you for being here. It's been
a
pleasure.
It's been great talking to you, actually.
And the book is wonderful.
Thank you.
And now I need to go and read the rest of your stuff. So.
Okay, great. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, yeah, it's a wonderful book. It's called Angels and Aliens, A Journey West. And anyway, if you have any comments about Writers on Writing, you can email me at bdemarcob@aol.com, or you can write to me in care of KUCI, P.O. Box 4362, Irvine, California 92616, or you can fax me at 949-760-1443. If you know of anyone who'd like to listen to my show or any show here on KUCI, it is internet accessible at www.KUCI.org. And KUCI also has a wide range of public affairs programs daily. One you should check out is Ava Park's Animal House, and it's on Thursday at 5. Next week, my guest will be New York literary agent David Vigliano. And mark your calendars, on April 14th, we'll be live at Borders celebrating National Poetry Month. So come on down. It'd be great to see you. The music you've heard during this show is by Brian Barrett, he does play blues at Sid's in Newport every Sunday and Monday night. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Chris is on next with music for Lunch Pails. Take care and thank you for listening, and happy St. Patrick's Day. Drive carefully. Now get to work and remember, it's all about writing, like there's no tomorrow.